Maine poet Richard Blanco reflects on how his life has changed since being asked to write and deliver the poem at President Obama's inauguration. Being selected as inaugural poet affected Richard Blanco so profoundly, he decided to write a book about the experience. He reflects on his role as the youngest, first immigrant, and first openly gay inaugural poet in his new memoir, For All of Us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey. He writes about coming up with the words to express what the nation needed to hear on Inauguration Day, on what his community of Bethel, Maine has meant to him throughout his journey, and how it has affected his commitment to the arts moving forward. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, our guest is inaugural poet Richard Blanco. We hope you'll take part, but first, the news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Ask some people about poetry, and they will wax philosophical about the use of language, the power of imagery and allegory, and the power of poetry for expressing the beauty and pain life puts in our path. Others, when asked about poetry, will say, why doesn't it always rhyme? My guest today is eminently qualified to speak about all things poetic. With me in the studio, Richard Blanco. Blanco was born in Madrid and immigrated to the United States as an infant with his Cuban exile family. He was raised in Miami and earned a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering and a Master's of Fine Arts in creative writing from Florida International University. He now lives in Bethel. Blanco delivered the inaugural poem at President Obama's second inauguration, and his memoir, For All of Us, One Today, was published last month. Of course, we want to hear from you during today's conversation. Does poetry move you, or do you find it intimidating? What would you like to ask Richard Blanco? Share your comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Richard Blanco, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Great to be back.
Thank you. You know, I wanted to start by talking about the book. What gave you the idea of writing essentially a memoir about writing a poem?
Well, I think the biggest reason was that everything happened so quickly and so, it was a life-changing event that happened in a matter of 3 weeks. And so, as Anais Nin said, writers taste life twice. And I felt I just needed, it was the impulse of the writer to go back and sort of look at all those details again, look at all those memories, go over them with a fine-tooth comb in some way just to capture what they really meant because it all happened so quickly and to savor them, you know, re-savor all those memories and realize what was really the story underneath all the stuff that sort of was happening on the surface. So that was one big thing. The other thing was I thought it was a great story. I'm one of only five people in our country that has ever experienced this. And I thought, why hasn't anybody written this before? So I thought it was a great story to share and have available for people to understand all this, all the things that didn't come out in interviews and all the really emotional journey that went into writing the three poems. So I think those were the two sort of main things. And maybe perhaps as a guidebook for the next inaugural poet, even though I don't want to give up my crown, so to speak, like Miss America. But
So, wait, you said one of five. So I know Robert Frost, Maya Angelou.
Miller Williams.
Okay.
And Elizabeth Alexander.
Pretty good company.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give away the whole memoir, but I wanted to ask you a few questions because, as you said, it's a great story. How did you find out you had been chosen as inaugural poet?
Well, I had been I was driving actually back to Bethel from New York City, and I had a class visit in Connecticut at a middle school. And just driving back, I think I was somewhere in Massachusetts. I don't know exactly where I was, but I got a text from my agent at the time. And with all capitals, like, call me back immediately and whatnot. And so I did, and I think I broke the law because I don't think you're supposed to call on the cell phone in Massachusetts, but I pulled over. There was a lot of traffic, and it was a very emotional moment. I think it was at first, it was kind of I couldn't get what he was trying to say. I was like, "What do you mean? Like, they want me to go to the White House to read a poem, or like, took me like 3 minutes or so to like realize, oh, like Robert Frost and like Maya Angelou. Okay, I got that. And then weirdly enough, for the first few minutes, I was kind of a little cautiously confident, because in some ways my work had always dealt about writing about America, what, you know, my place in America, what is America, what is the American dream, what does it mean to be American. So I thought, I got this for about 5 minutes. And then the other thing immediately after that was just sort of this immense wave of gratitude and thinking mostly about my parents and my grandparents and sort of this idea that, you know, their story, that my story began with their story. And it just felt like this was as much a part of them, thanks to all the sacrifices and hard work that they did and their emphasis on education and making sure we had books and shoes, so mm-hmm. as the poem says. So that was just really an overwhelming feeling. I just had to pull over to the side of the road and basically weep.
And what was your mom's reaction?
Interestingly, you know, there's no word in Spanish for inauguration. I mean, there's a word called inauguration, but it doesn't mean the same thing. So it took me like 3 minutes to tell her what it was. And the word in Spanish is actually toma de posesión, which means taking of possession, which kind of spoke culturally about our histories versus, you know, versus sort of the Spanish,
right,
you know, rule versus the principles of what this country is founded upon. So it was really interesting. I found that interesting. Of course, she was very excited, and she immediately started making plans to not immediately. I had asked her eventually if she wanted to sit with me at the platform, and as I detailed in the book, and she was kind of like, and I told her, she knows English, but, you know, she doesn't like to speak it. And I said, you're going to be around the president. You're going to have to maybe say something in English. Don't go if you're going to get all nervous and stuff. And being a mother, she said, well, I'll go if you want me to go. She probably already brought her dress. And
you were given a very short time period. Was it 3 weeks in which to write two poems? I can't even imagine what I know of poetry writing, years often for a poem, right?
Right. Yeah. I can draft a poem in a week, but then you put it away and over time it becomes the real, the
jewel. Composts.
It composts. And so it was three poems in 3 weeks, basically. And I tried to write one per week. There's something interesting, you know, there's something to be said about the timed exercise too. I mean, I didn't dilly-dally. I mean, if I started a draft and it didn't work, you know, as I write about in the book, you know, it just, you know, I just throw it away. So on the other side, I'm glad they didn't give me 6 months to write this, because I would probably either gained or lost 50 pounds. And I would have just probably ruined the poem some ways, because I think I would have gone over it too much or ended up with one of the first drafts to begin with anyway.
Right.
So the pressure was on, but I did nothing but write. And luckily I had immediately a support system, including my partner Mark, including all the townspeople. Bethel was amazing in supporting us so that I could just write for those 3 weeks.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because I wanted to read something from your book and have you talk about it. You mentioned that you grew up in Miami and live in Bethel, Maine now. You wrote, although worlds apart, both my nostalgic memories of my Miami and my present-day Bethel came together through the writing of one today. I realized that both communities held several essential things in common for me: respect for the importance of each individual, compassion for one another, and most important, a deep abiding sense of dignity and unity. My poetic sensibilities understood these as the most endearing and enduring qualities of the American spirit. One today became an extension of those values and fundamental beliefs that I wished America to reconnect as a nation village, especially in the light of so much strife and political division in recent years. In my mind, the purpose of being the inaugural poet and my poem was to transcend politics and envision a new relationship between all Americans. My sense from reading that and from reading your book is that the process of writing the poem changed how you view yourself as an American and how you viewed your fellow citizens.
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was really one of the main things I wanted to put in the book, was that really life-changing experience that had to do not so much with from meeting Beyonce or none of that stuff, but you know, my theme in my work, my constant question has always been, where's home? Where do I belong? What does that mean? What does that look like? And, you know, it's a question that really has no definite answer, but that's why it's part of art, because it's all about exploring those questions. And during the actual process of being at the inauguration, was life-changing in the sense that I felt like I had finally found home, or I should say that I was home all along. The sense of that my story, that my mother's story, that all those, you know, 800,000 people out there, each one of those stories was America. I really connected with those fundamental beliefs of founding beliefs of the country. And it's palpable when you're up there. I mean, I understood why those people all go to the inauguration. It's a very powerful moment. And I felt like a little school kid again, you know, like first learning the national anthem or whatnot, that sort of joy of coming into contact with those ideals and reconnecting them and realizing that I truly believed, loved, and belonged in this country. And as an immigrant, there's always a little part of you that says, well, you're not quite 100% American. America, some other little boy or some other place I haven't been to. And that, you know, was – that really changed the way I look at myself and my place. Bethel, as you just read, you know, I grew up in a very tight community and a tight Cuban exile community. And Bethel reminded me of that community. And one thing I didn't put in there is, of course, the gossip as well. I often told my mom, you know, I feel more like I'm in Cuba when I'm in Bethel than in Miami, because, you know, the small town feeling has that tight knit community that I grew up around, and that sense of all helping each other. And I think that's a fundamental belief I always carried with me since childhood, and it was rekindled for me in Bethel.
Mm. Now, I have to ask, you were having this interview on a very interesting day. I wouldn't usually ask you a political question, but yesterday, President Obama shook Raul Castro's hand at the memorial service for Nelson Mandela. What was your reaction to that from your unique life experience? And
well, I don't really carry, you know, the second generation, or I should say the first generation Cuban American has a little bit of a different perspective. I mean, I wasn't born in Cuba. We don't carry the same sort of history in our heads or the same pain or sense of loss. You know, there is some of that, but so I honestly think it was a great moment. I think it's time in some ways that we at least begin a conversation with Cuba, because it's really passé already. It becomes, I mean, one of the interesting things when this whole inauguration happened, I thought I was going to get all these questions about the embargo in Cuba. I didn't get any of those questions, because it sort of just seems like everybody's just like waiting, you know. It's get like this idea that's going to happen. I'm sure some of the older generation will be a little bit peeved by that. But how long can you hold a grudge? And I know things happen, and believe me, I know both sides of the fence. I have a very sort of middle view, because I've been to Cuba several times, and I know what that's about. And I also have my mother's and my parents' stories and what that was about. But at the end of the day, to use another recent event, you know, as Nelson Mandela, you know, what would be the point? The idea that he came out of that and said, no, I'm not going to lash back, but I'm going to embrace this with love and light and moving forward in a direction that, you know, at the end of the day, that's the only real resolution, is like, how can we find some connection despite, you know, it's just like a lover's quarrel. You know, you have to at some point, you know, connect.
Well, something you talk about in the book, and this is a little bit of a 90-degree turn here, but not only did you think a lot about your role as an American, but also about the role of poetry in American culture. And you're sort of like, you've jumped on the horse and grabbed the sword now, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all because of the inauguration. I mean, I was one of those poets, like all of us, that usually say, oh, poetry, nobody reads poetry. Poetry doesn't sell. Poetry is a hard life. And I'm not saying that's not true. But the inauguration really proved to me, I mean, the incredible response, letters from and drawings from, you know, third, fourth graders and inaugural poems all the way up to military personnel writing me, to the parents, to people that were around when Frost, when they actually heard Frost read, the scale of what the people's response to poetry when they're given a chance with contemporary work. And I think that people just stop reading poetry for things that I have my own sort of theories about that. But I saw when they're given the chance, it meant the incredible response to poetry as it's always been, very powerful. I mean, people telling me about crying, about feeling like they were finally felt like included in America. Everyone from immigrants to, like, you know, people from Bengali, you know, like this whole idea proved to me that poetry actually has a great potential and a great place in America. And it's really, to me, a matter of that, I think, of how we teach it and thinking about how we can help educators and empower educators to really feel comfortable in poetry so that new generations of readers will read poetry and not sort of have that tenseness with it. It doesn't happen so much in Latin American countries because it's never, and it's been my experience at least in Cuba, that the poetry has never removed itself from the folklore. And I think that's why Frost was so powerful, because he was entrenched in the very folklore of the country. And it's very complex work, and yet it's still very accessible work. It has many levels. And so I'm thinking about ways in which we can – I think the key is to – why I've been doing a lot of readings in this year and whatnot. I almost feel like I'm evangelizing poetry. I feel like – you know, every time I go to a reading, the three or four people tell me, I've never bought a book of poetry before. And it's like, praise hallelujah. Like, we have someone converted.
Good.
You know, and I love doing that because it's I saw it firsthand, and I've always believed it as a poet, though in America, there's nothing of that scale except the inauguration that really connects the average, whatever that may mean, American with poetry, and suddenly their hearts and minds open up to it.
Great. Well, what we're going to do during this program, we're about to go to a break, and we'll take your calls and questions after that. But before we go to the break, we're going to have an excerpt from one today. And by the end of the program, we will have played the entire poem. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, America, one today. One sun rose on us today, kindled over our shores, peeking over the Smokies, greeting the faces of the Great Lakes, spreading a simple truth across the Great Plains, then charging across the Rockies. One light waking up rooftops, under each one a story told by our silent gestures moving across windows. My face, your face, millions of faces in morning's mirrors, each one yawning to life, crescendoing into our day. The pencil yellow school buses, the rhythm of traffic lights, fruit stands, apples, limes, and oranges arrayed like rainbows, begging our praise.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Gorham Bike and Ski, a full-service ski shop located in downtown Portland, gorhambike.com. By Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. And by V-Charge Heat, providing sustainable thermal storage heating alternatives to oil, kerosene, or propane. More at goodcleanheat.com/MPBN.
British actor Michael Sheen played David Frost in the film Frost Nixon and Prime Minister Tony Blair in The Queen and two other films. On the next Fresh Air, Sheen talks about those roles and playing sex researcher William Masters.
We are doctors, and I simply want to answer the question, what happens to the body during sex?
Sheen stars in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join MPBN on Facebook and over 10,000 friends of MPBN for notes about special programming and events, questions for you and from you about our television, radio, and online programming and services, conversations with other listeners who may not always have the same opinion as you, also schedule updates, information, news about MPBN, We invite you to become an MPBN Facebook friend and connect with other listeners and viewers. If you like MPBN On Air, like us on Facebook too.
Silver trucks, heavy with oil or paper, bricks or milk, teeming over highways alongside us on our way to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry, or ring up groceries, as my mother did for 20 years, so I could write this poem for all of us today. All of us, as vital as the one light we move through, the same light on blackboards with lessons for the day, equations to solve, history to question, or atoms imagined, the I have a dream we all keep dreaming, or the impossible vocabulary of sorrow that won't explain the empty desks of 20 children marked absent today and forever.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Poetry and One Poet's Life. That was a clip from One Today, the inaugural poem written by our guest, poet Richard Blanco. We will hear the entire poem by the end of the program today. Since the inauguration almost a year ago, Blanco was named a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow and received an honorary doctorate from McAllister College. We would like you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go down to Sophia in Orono. Hi, Sophia. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
It's an honor to speak with you, Mr. Blanco. You spoke of people telling you that they were crying and sobbing through your inaugural poem, and that was me. And it meant so very much to me. I'm a very political person, very active. I've been very disheartened by the political atmosphere of our country. I love our country so much. And just listening to your poem is making me cry again. But that poem gave me such a gift. It was such a needed, necessary gift at that moment. And I just wanted to say thank you. It was so powerful. The whole concept of one and light, and we all have the same light every day in America shining on us. So I'm sure it brought positive good to this world, and I just wanted to say thank you very much.
Thank you, Sophia. It was interesting, as I write in the book, that initially I felt the self-imposed pressure to write a much more politically charged poem, given all the hats I was wearing and actually the big sombrero I was wearing. And I realized that, I think what you're responding to, that the role of the poet in the inauguration as well, I think, in society is to how do we rise above some of these, above some of these things and give a vision of what we could be, or, the better part of who we are, or the higher self. And I had to make a conscious choice that scared me a little, was to not continue the battle, so to speak, but rather to propose a peace treaty, if it were, like, where could we be, where we should be, which is really echoing back to our very founding fathers and the principles of that. And as I've read it more and more throughout this year, I've realized how very personal that poem is to me. Even though I don't use the first person, I realize how much of that poem I really poured my heart out into. And I mean, that gets into the process of creative writing, where sometimes you write things and you're not even, it's your subconscious, like, really bubbling up. But it's this whole idea that we all have that's universal, is like, excuse me, now you're making me cry. This idea that we all want to go home. We all want to be in that place of belonging and togetherness. And that's something that's always been sort of what I've longed for. And I think that's what a lot of people are responding to in between the lines.
Thank you, Sophia. You've had a lot of comments along those lines, haven't you?
Yeah.
It must be incredibly gratifying, but also a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible charge, so to speak. And what keeps me going, as we were talking about before, this sort of another piece of that came out of this whole experience that's in the book is sort of finding a new sense of purpose for my life and for my life as a writer. And the sense of if poetry can do that to people like Sophia, I mean, this is I want to put it out there even more and more. So it helps me to keep on going in that sense because it has been. I mean, I have bookings until 2015. So, and that's insane for a poet, you know. I can't stop saying no.
Well, I think a lot of people will be happy about that. We're going to go to Loretta in Biddeford. Hi, Loretta. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, and good afternoon. Thank you so much for having this guest here. I just wanted to say, Richard, we had the opportunity to meet you last winter when you did your presentation up at Merrill Auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And what an absolute delight. And you are so correct. When I looked around the audience and saw people that I knew that didn't know they were interested in poetry and seeing the age range from really very young people to people my age, I almost didn't mind getting the parking ticket from the excursion. And among the group that I was with, we had a woman who had never been to a poetry reading. And that always strikes me as unusual, having had such a history of the politics of the 60s and 70s and everything and being in those readings. So it's nice to bring people into the arena, whether it's because of a political event or whatever. But thank you so much. It was an absolute delight, and you are a charmer.
Thank you. I think that's a great comment, and I think you're right about. I mean, what you said made me echo back to the maybe a time when poetry was much more. I wouldn't say the center of our lives, but was much more just part of our lives in general. I mean, the days of the 60s and that era when music and poetry were the beats and things were amazing happening. There was. Poetry had a voice in America in a way that wasn't sort of kept in a closet somewhere. I have my theories of why that's happened over the last few decades, but I certainly love that spirit. That there's a line from a poet, a Salvadoranian poet, Robert Dalton, that says poetry is like bread; it's for everyone. And I think I live my life by that.
Great. Well, Loretta, thank you so much for your call. We have a Facebook post from Marlene. Richard, I was given a poem to read by a 14-year-old high school student. Her teacher said it's worthy of being published. The poem is about the grandfather she never knew who performed with the likes of Chuck Mangione. What kind of advice may I give to this student?
How old again?
14.
14? I think that's a young age. I think one of the hard things about teaching poetry and guiding poetry is that poetry it asks us for a lot of wisdom and a lot of life experience to sort of get at the gravitas of a poem. But as far as advice, just encourage. And it's like reading, you know. Sometimes people are like, well, you know, there's like a reading snob. If they're reading, even if it's a junk novel, they're reading. You know, like the same idea. Let them write and practice and encourage and let them write through whatever they need to process. Always with a little bit of craft and trying instructing them on some of the basics of the art, I think is important too. Not sort of just excusing, just because you wrote it, it's perfect and fine. But the idea that poetry is also a crafted art, that it's something that involves its own sort of study. But the most important thing that I always think about poetry is supporting the emotional element, the emotional center of the poem. And recognizing that when you're reading someone else's work or when you're helping a student work and work on their poetry is to sort of focus on what it is that we come to poetry because we have something obviously very intimate and important to say and feel on the page. And that's important to remember. I think that's the biggest way you can support them is always keeping focus on that.
You talk about the intimacy, and it is very intimate. And your memoir is do you just put aside the, boy, I might be exposing myself here? Do you just have to say, I can't think about that and sort of plow forward?
Yeah. You know, there's a tricky, and I think I've always understood this since I started writing, and it does relate to Marlene's Facebook post. You know, that most art, I think, but I can speak for poetry, there's this weird irony, which is that you're supposed to tell your most emotional, passionate, and deepest intimate details of your, not necessarily details, but it comes from that space. But you also have to realize that you also have to transcend your very story, because it is an art. So you make choices and you write art not necessarily to just be self-consumed in it, but to also realize that your story is in some way an archetype or is a moment of transcendent that then becomes universal. And Frost, you know, I think was coined that the details, the universal is in the details. And it's this idea that if we tell a story that's vivid and passionate and felt and urgent enough, at some point it becomes everyone's story. And I find that helps me to understand and be sort of an open book, because in some ways I'm doing it not just to expose myself, but rather to connect. Because at the end of the day, for me personally, poetry is about connecting with people and having people connect with each other, with their communities, with their families, whatever it is. And so if I can offer up my life, my experiences through the art, and have someone have a light bulb go off and trigger, then I figure it's all worth it.
We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for poet Richard Blanco. But before that break, more of his inaugural poem, One Today.
Many prayers, but one light, breathing color into stained glass windows, life into the faces of bronze statues, warmth onto the steps of our museums and park benches as mothers watch children slide into the day. One ground, our ground, rooting us to every stalk of corn, every head of wheat sown by sweat and hands, hands gleaning coal or planting windmills in deserts and hilltops that keep us warm, hands digging trenches, routing pipes and cables, hands as worn as my father's, cutting sugarcane so my brother and I could have books and shoes.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by VCharge Heat, providing sustainable thermal storage heating alternatives to oil, kerosene, or propane. More at goodcleanheat.com/MPBN. Tis the season again when both MPBN radio and television offer special programming in observance of the holidays, Advent, Hanukkah, Solstice, Christmas, New Year's. Your member magazine Experience has detailed listings, and you can also find a complete listing online at mpbn.net. For all of our radio and television holiday specials, just click on the holiday banner. Enjoy.
Hi, this is Robert Moody, music director of the Portland Symphony Orchestra. Join us Wednesday, December 11th, 8 p.m. for Main Stage. The PSO goes for Baroque in this incredible concert featuring Bach's Cantata No. 140, known as Sleeper's Wake. Also on the program, the Corelli Christmas Concerto, the Bieber Battaglia, and Respighi's Great Ancient Airs and Dances Suite No. 1. The concert features the Choral Arts Society and Hugh Floyd, my great colleague, as guest conductor. See you on Main Stage.
The dust of farms and deserts, cities and plains, mingled by one wind, our breath. Breathe. Hear it through the day's gorgeous din of honking cabs, buses launching down avenues, the symphony of footsteps, guitars and screeching subways, the unexpected songbird on your clothesline. Hear squeaky playground swings, trains whistling or whispers across cafe tables. Hear the doors we open each day for each other, saying, hello, shalom, buongiorno, howdy, namaste, or buenos dias, in the language my mother taught me, in every language, spoken into one wind, carrying our lives without prejudice, as these words break from my lips.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling today on the program, The Power of Poetry. With me in the studio, poet Richard Blanco, who was chosen to serve as the fifth inaugural poet of the United States. We've been listening to part of his inaugural poem, One Today. We would like you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Going to Janet and Bethel. Janet, you're a neighbor of Richard's.
Very fortunately, yes. Thank you, Richard, again for your work. I've always felt that the poet is sort of the soul, the being on earth who captures the initial nudge of the kind of the unconscious wisdom, or perhaps even the unconscious worry of humanity, and that the poet is the person given that role or task to bring it forth to the conscious world. And it's been, even just listening on the radio show today of your poem again, it wells up just emotion inside of me, and that is just the true sense of that something gets really touched with poetry. So thank you for your work again.
Thank you, Janet. you know, it's interesting because as you made your comment, I realized that one of the driving or motivators in my work or why I write poetry is for the same reason. I come to poetry when I'm not sure what I'm feeling about something. I just know that I have something that I want to, it's that kernel, as you were saying, I have to explore that. And I have to come to some higher understanding of what that massive, just raw emotion or energy is. So I think, you know, I think poets come to poetry, I think, a lot with that. And when you read it on the page, it kind of echoes that same thing for you. That moment of discovery on the page triggers something of your own discovery in your own life. And on a larger level, it reminds me of something I was just reading, one of my favorite sort of quotes, and I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm disoriented, but I forget if it's Byron or Shelley now, but same thing, the romantics.
Old guy, yes.
Same guys, old guys from England, but that poets were the unacknowledged legislators of the world, and something like that. And it's true. They said something that even a poem sometimes takes me months, years, and I'm still learning something from it, from my own poetry and from other people's poems. There's this incredible sort of ground, basic truth that it discovers.
Janet, thanks for your call. Going to Amy in Lock Mills. Hi, Amy. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
we're almost neighbors, too.
Yeah.
I met you at your reading at Gould Academy, and I've actually purchased all of your books and been reading them. And the thing that strikes me is that you've helped to make poetry accessible. When I went to the reading at Gould, I looked around and I saw people there that I was surprised to see at a poetry reading.
Right.
I think that they were learning that it's not all obscure and difficult. It can be accessible and understandable. And I just kind of wanted to link that to something I saw on your Facebook page this morning, which was the billboard advertising your reading at Syracuse.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we don't have billboards in Maine, but if where there are billboards, how great would it be if poetry had a place of prominence on billboards like car dealerships and, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Of vodka.
There was a program in the New York subway for a while. Is it still going on where there are poems in the subway?
It reminded me of that. Yeah, this is something that this is a billboard near Syracuse. I'm doing a charity event for Building Futures and the ARC, which is for people of intellectual and developmental disabilities. And what I love is that what poetry, another thing I've been discovering is how poetry can make a difference in our world, not just sort of in a bookstore, but how it can be a catalyst for bringing people together for causes. And this is something I've been doing the past year, you know, with advocacy groups and just sort of poetry creating that campfire in which we can all gather and storytell and unite as a community for reasons beyond just even the poetry. The thing of accessibility, it's a thorn in my side. There was a recent New York Times a little piece about this whole debate of accessibility and how, you know, is accessibility, you know, washing away poetry, or is it like, you know, degenerating the art? And I blow a gasket, because since when is accessibility and complexity, since when are those two words antonyms? A poem can be incredibly accessible and incredibly complex at the same time. And if you look, for example, at a Robert Frost poem, you can read it at many levels. You have the accessibility that lets you in emotionally, and someone who may not be as versed or read in poetry will get something out of it, but then a scholar will get something else out of it. I often, you know, quote, think of Shakespeare the same way, you know, down in the Globe Theater on the bottom where mm-hmm. what would be, you know, I don't want to pick up plumbers, but I don't know, like the plumbers, whatever. There's just the everyday working class folk.
Those plays were written for right, everyday people,
right.
Yeah.
And then the Queen of England sitting on the top row, you know, and each one was getting something out of it. And I have a personal idea that, you know, if I can't open the door to someone, like I said, I write poems for people like my mom in a way, you know, that's in some ways my audience. I want my poems to open that door for people that are not necessarily versed in poetry. And I also want it to be, you know, respected by my peers and all that. And I try to work at it both levels. And in some ways, I think the harder job is to take something complex and break it down, as Einstein would say, you know, that you know, something to paraphrase. Anybody can make something complicated and make it more complicated. It's the ability to simplify and distill to its most basic element. And that's sort of my aesthetic in poetry.
All right. Well, Amy, thanks for your call. Going to Jim in Portland. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Richard, I've been recently just reading some of your earlier things and absolutely love it. And I have two quick questions. First is, of poets or writers in general, past or present, who are the greatest influences on you and your work? And second of all, writers past or present, who do you enjoy reading? Who would be your favorite just to pick up and when you have a few minutes and read? And I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks, Jim. One of my greatest influences, I think, has been Elizabeth Bishop, for that same reason that I was just actually mentioning. You can read an Elizabeth Bishop poem and on the face value, it's this accessible poem about a fish, and then you read it again. And you read it again, and you read it again, and you're like, this is not about a fish. This is about, you know, beauty and life and all these other things. So Elizabeth Bishop is a strong influence, a poet that's a lot very focused on imagery and an imagist, so to speak. And I also have a kinship with her because I think psychologically she was orphaned when she was young. And psychologically, I think she was always looking for home. And mm-hmm. so I always felt she was someone who was in a psychological exile. I love to read. I love Philip Levine. I love I was talking with Jennifer earlier about Robert Haas, who's always been a great influence. My mentor, Campbell McGrath. And these are all poets that I think have that quality of as Amy was saying earlier, you know, that quality of accessibility. And it's no wonder that they've been successful because they have that accessibility, but they're also incredibly complex poets. And so I tend to like those voices that have that sort of multifaceted element in their work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for your call. And going to Joy in Penobscot. Go ahead, Joy.
Bienvenido, Ricardo.
Gracias.
Soy americana, pero estudié el español y es una oportunidad de practicar.
Muy bien, entonces.
Me encanta de oír sus ideas y sentidos sobre poesía, especialmente la importancia de la emoción.
Sí.
Y estoy muy alegre de que usted está en el estado de Maine. Qué regalo.
Gracias.
Sí, nada más.
Okay, I'll try to paraphrase Joy. But basically, she had said that she loves this idea of this the importance of emotion in poetry, and was thanking me for being, I guess, Cuban in Maine in some ways. That's a very important thing, Joy. Actually, una cosa muy importante. One of the things I think we have problems in educating in the educational process of poetry is that poetry, like more than any other genre, perhaps any other art except music, elicits emotion from us. It wants us to cry. It wants us to laugh. It wants us to slap somebody. It wants you to call your mother-in-law and give her what for. It wants to rise emotion in you. And yet in a classroom, that's very hard to do because we have to sort of have some subjective teaching. And I think that's where some people are turned off with poetry, because I've been asking a lot of students lately, and they say one of the biggest turnoffs is that they'll respond to a poem saying, this reminded me of this, or this reminded me of my mom, or this time when we went on vacation this place, or my dad who died when I was five. And it's usually shut off in the classroom because we don't know what to do with that. So I think it's important that we remember that poetry, first of all, the first question you should ask when you read a poem or teach a poem is, not what does it mean, but what is it making you feel? Then you'll discover the meaning.
Okay. Well, I have a feeling most teachers are busy right now, but somehow we'll get that out to them. We have time for one quick question. Nicole, go ahead.
Hi, Richard. I'm Nicole from the Maine Coast Bookshop in Damariscotta.
Oh, hi.
Hi, and I'm looking forward to having you come and speak on May 3rd at the library. And I do think that poetry is definitely starting to soar in popularity, particularly since your inaugural poem, because we now have like two poets, Mary Oliver and Billy Collins, on the Indie Bestsellers list, which is great. But I wonder if you have any suggestions for how we can promote poetry in bookstores, other than just leading a customer directly over to the poetry section and handing them some books.
Or filling the front window with poetry books.
I don't know. I've never been a bookseller, but I would think having poetry read. I know that people are often amazed when they go see a poet for the first time. Not always. but that there's something, the oral nature of poetry really hooks people into poetry as well. Because it's so much part of the DNA of poetry. It was oral tradition. I mean, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago before we had books and pen and paper. So it was, I think that's still in the poetry. I think that attracts people. And I don't know how you can craft the message of, you know, poetry is not what you think it is. Give it a chance, you know. Use some of the names that you mentioned. I mean, certainly, yeah, Mary, who cannot read a Mary Oliver poem and just die, you know, and the idea that just give it a chance is an important message.
Anyway, thank you so much for your call, Nicole. I love Mary Oliver, too. So Richard Blanco, thank you so much for joining us today. Richard Blanco was the fifth inaugural poet of the United States. The title of his just released memoir is For All of Us, One Today. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and our volunteer Scott McAuliffe answered your calls. We had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a discussion about loneliness, what it means, who it affects, and how to feel more connected. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. We are leaving just a few seconds, a couple minutes early today, so that we can hear the end of Richard Blanco's inaugural poem, One Today.
One sky. Since the Appalachians and Sierras claimed their majesty, and the Mississippi and Colorado worked their way to the sea, thank the work of our hands, weaving steel into bridges, finishing one more report for the boss on time, stitching another wound or uniform, the first brushstroke on a portrait, or the last floor on the Freedom Tower, jutting into the sky that yields to our resilience. One sky, toward which we sometimes lift our eyes, tired from work, some days guessing at the weather of our lives, some days giving thanks for a love that loves you back, sometimes praising a mother who knew how to give, or forgiving a father who couldn't give what you wanted. We head home through the gloss of rain or weight of snow or the plum blush of dusk, but always, always home, always under one sky, our sky, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping on every rooftop and every window of one country, all of us facing the stars. Hope, a new constellation, waiting for us to map it, waiting for us to name it together.